Hello, and thanks for having a listen to Secure Insights with NDK Cyber. This week, I'm very excited to be joined by Cam Chumbly-Sultani. Cam is someone I've known for a little while now. And so Cam started out his life in the US Navy in various different roles there before transitioning into cybersecurity in the commercial space, becoming an expert in sort of all things OT, IoT security. He's worked for some of the biggest names in the civilian sector, if you like, in the commercial space, continues to do good work now. We dive into his background, his experience, transitioning from military to civilian life, what you can take as actions in terms of how to secure your OT security environment better from the low hanging fruit right to your more complex solutions. So really excited to share this one with you and hope you enjoy.
Hey Cam, well, thank you very much for jumping on and joining me.
Yeah, absolutely, James. Happy to be here. Always super excited to get back to the community and talk to people about OT cybersecurity. So looking forward to it.
Awesome, man. Well, I know there's a lot of value to be found here. So just before we dive into a few of these sort of talking points we've lined up, do you want to give the listeners just a brief overview of your background and sort of what you do on a day-to-day basis at the moment?
Yeah, sure thing. So started the career off pretty much day I turned 18, went to the Navy in the United States. I was a C-130 flight engineer, so I sat between the pilot and the co-pilot, and I was in charge of all the mechanical systems, so anything from pneumatic, electrical, structural mechanics, aviation life support, critical systems, to electronics itself. So pretty much anything you could be covered in, my hands were involved, right? But loved my job, did that for about 10 years, and then in the middle of my trajectory, went to the Naval Academy where I studied cyber operations. And then that's where I really got integrated with doing some federal work. Specifically, I did some time with an NSA-sponsored internship where I pretty much attacked control systems on a simulated city that was called Dream Valley through an organization called MISSI. And it was pretty crazy because the entire time I'd had an operational background of working with these control devices and really getting my hands dirty, but not necessarily understanding the cybersecurity aspect. So I spent that entire duration attacking these PLCs and looking how they work with different traffic lighting systems and electrical grid and plumbing systems, and actually mapping out the network architecture and understanding how holistically all of those things work together. And then did some time with Naval Special Warfare and also some policy research for the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, working on the NDAA for 2021 for how the government would strengthen cybersecurity posture. Pivoted after that to a family foundation after I left the military, where I focused more on strategy and policy for national security, cybersecurity, and then a big passion of mine in veteran mental health and veteran healthcare. So then after pivoting after that, I went to Dragos actually. So I kept getting pulled back into that cybersecurity Kool-Aid for OT security. And I was doing a little bit of school there where I was getting my master's concurrently in cyber, went to Dragos. Really big name, and was an industrial cyber consultant where we did anything from crown jewel analysis, architecture review, network assessment, strategy revisions, you name it, across every vertical of critical infrastructure. And when I say vertical, I mean oil and gas, utility, manufacturing, healthcare, pretty much all the flavors that encompass that spectrum of infrastructure. And then I said, hey, this is amazing, but I've always kind of been involved in that public sector side of things. So then Dragos, I moved into a federal solution architect role where I was responsible as the technical counterpart in sales for deploying all of our security solutions and accounts under the DoD, Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security, Department of Energy, pretty much everything in the spectrum of the public sector and all the intelligence community. So it was great. I loved it. It was awesome. That's where I got the bug, I think, and it kept growing. And currently, I'm loving my role here at Cisco, where I'm a technical solutions architect, and I do anything that involves industrial. So not just industrial security, but the industrial Internet of Things or IIoT, because we love our acronyms, and there's always more acronyms out there, right? So right now, I'm doing anything with ruggedized equipment, so that equipment that can handle really hard operating temperatures, vibrations, shock. Anything that's outside of those really rough industrial processes or environments to multi-wireless access solutions like LoRaWAN, Wi-Fi, 5G, private 5G, LTE, backhaul, mesh networks, you name it. To, of course, my favorite passion, obviously, on this call is cybersecurity monitoring visibility solutions. threat detection and vulnerability management. So that was a mouthful, but that's pretty much my background where I'm at right now.
No, that's awesome. Yeah, there's a lot of things in there. There's a lot of threads to tug, I guess. Just I want to make this more about the OT security side of things, but just going back one step there, you mentioned around your transition from the military to OT to OT security. Was there any point in there that was like a particular this cybersecurity stuff sounds really interesting because you're clearly passionate about this. You come across great in this space. You've done many webinars and speaking engagements on this already. So that's a sort of a passion and an area you're really keen on. Is there a was there a point where you went, oh, you know what, this is me for the foreseeable future now. I love this stuff.
It's crazy when I think back as the kid that was playing video games and breaking apart controllers to put in mods. So instead of just pulling one trigger, I could click it and have 1,000 triggers at the same time. So I always loved technology. And at one point, when I wasn't flying on C-130s in the Navy, I was actually a mission operations program manager where we would manage all the logistics for pretty much anything on a global scale, all across the spectrum of security and mission impact and criticality, leaving it at that, right? So had the opportunity to work with a lot of very unique and special individuals and groups globally. And I think that's where the security piece really started triggering in the back of my head to recognize the nature and the severity of some of these missions that were happening and thinking, wow, this is pretty impressive. And then as I was flying, I was augmented typically with personnel that were also performing other operations. And so it just really had my interest. So then when I started studying cyber operations at the Naval Academy, I mean, the program was phenomenal. And is anything from technical to policy work, I'd say probably 75% technical, encompassing anything from network engineering to security to programming with Python, Bash, even lower level languages like machine code and assembly, to policy of looking at cybersecurity law, the human factor. So really a great holistic program. And actually my first year there, there was a program that was cyber physical systems. And I thought to myself, man, I don't know what this is, but it sounds pretty cool. So you're telling me that when we think about cybersecurity, it's not just business computers, enterprise networks, but you can actually have kinetic effects on the real world. And then everybody's go-to topic you hear when you come into cybersecurity, first thing you're going to hear about pretty much is Stuxnet or NotPetya, right? So, or a WannaCry, and you start researching, oh my gosh, so you're saying there could have been an impact on nuclear centrifuges due to some sort of human factor. And it was interesting in the class, we actually had chips that we were programming through C++, and they were connected to simulated elevators. And what we were doing is we were using what's called PID controllers that we were programming these little chips for that would make the elevators move faster or slower and try to compromise how much impact they were having as they were going up and down. Within 10 minutes, we were all destroying these elevators in class, and the teachers were furious. But at that point, I think it really gave me an aha, right? Because I'd had a mechanical background already, being in the military for so long and working with operational equipment like that and all the electrical equipment in the first place. And then being a nerd, I think by nature, James, it really just all hit me. And that's wherever I pursued the opportunity to go attack some of those control systems through my time at the Naval Academy and working with different government organizations. So it's very odd. And when you talk to people about their journeys into industrial cybersecurity, it's perfect because people come from all different flavors and shapes and sizes to get into OT security. And there's no one size fits all.
Yes, no, that's certainly something we've seen. And like you say, there's so many specialized areas within that. I mean, you mentioned earlier on this call here that we can sort of group it under the OT, IoT, security, IIoT,
Yeah, exactly.
ICS. There's a few terminologies that, although are different in their own right, do interlink. So just, I guess, on that at the moment, what are you seeing as the sort of the overall state of the OT security space at the moment?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And before going into that, I just want to make a plug for anybody that is looking to go into OT security. It may seem almost impossible to break into that field, cybersecurity in the first place, but OT security maybe even more so. Just wanted to throw a little confidence out there to people and say, if it's something you're trying to pursue, and it's a phenomenal field and a phenomenal community that I'm happy to talk about in a second, and that overall threat landscape, James,
Yeah.
But people can also start in the IT realm and pivot to OT, or you can go work at an asset owner like an oil or manufacturer or utility that works in IT and then move in, or maybe even become a control engineer and pivot that point, right? Even if you have to take a step back to make a couple steps forward in the future, it's worth every second because I can personally say I love and I'm very passionate about what I do. And every person I've met in the community also feels the same. So a little plug for anybody out there that's trying to work with great guys like James and the rest of his team and to make that magic happen. But
That's no, awesome. Thank you.
so
So, in
yeah.
fact, on that, I guess if I'm a controls engineer now, I want to get into cybersecurity without spending, thousands of dollars or maybe
Yeah.
education. Is there sort of a one or two things you would look at first of all to just sort of cement if this is my next step for me? So, I'm a controls engineer now. I think I'm interested in cybersecurity before I go ahead and sign up to a master's or anything. Would you say
Yeah.
there's anything you could sort of look at first of all?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of times, I mean, those control engineers, they're subject matter experts when it comes to the industrial processes themselves. Nobody on the plant is going to be more familiar with those processes than a plant engineer. They are the go-to person. What I would encourage, though, and this all goes back to the big scheme of things, whether OT security, cybersecurity, whatever realm you're looking at, whatever flavor, networking is key, right? And I think before you decide to make a jump and spend everything in your piggy bank to get formal educational training or some sort of certs, go talk with the info security team at the corporation. Go talk with the network engineers. And a lot of times, these control engineers are going to work with other plant operators that may be responsible for the industrial network to start asking them what they do in their day-to-day job. If you could shadow them for a day, how your control processes may work with some of the network engineering on their manufacturing plants or their management execution systems, otherwise known as your MES. And so as you start getting that visibility and networking, it's going to potentially allow you a chance to pivot down the road within the organization. Some companies even have a rotational program where you're allowed to shadow another business unit or another team for a certain allotted amount of time because, in the end, it's only going to make the organization better. So, before you jump, you can go shadow. There's also a ton of free resources out there. I mean, you can find anything for any vertical. There's free virtual PLCs that you can train on online. There's great, great free courses by Department of Homeland Security under CISA for industrial control system. There's a lot of stuff out there. I mean, I know people that they'll even connect on LinkedIn, and this happened to me personally. And somebody sent me a PLC. I got one right here, actually, in my little piggy bank of gear. You know, someone sent me a PLC to play around with. So the community is very welcoming and very engaging. Don't get discouraged. You don't have to spend everything at once. Just take it bit by bit.
I think that's fantastic advice. Yeah, always massive advocate of the networking piece, and with LinkedIn at the fingertips these days, in such a globally connected world, you'd be silly not to, I think. So yeah, and people are always happy to help, like you say, in this space and indeed others. So I think that's very,
Yeah,
very good advice. Very good
for
advice.
sure. It's funny. I mean, even just the audience, there's times where James and I have talked where I've messaged James and said, "Hey, this is a great candidate," or "he or she or they're amazing. You might want to meet them just for networking piece." And James says, "I've already been talking to them. We've already connected." That's how small the community is. And I guess how good James is as well. Two-hatted right there.
It's not little old me. It's the community, I guess, coming together. But
Exactly. There you go.
no, thank you. I think there's a lot of value in that, and I think a lot of people will take from that. So, OT security at the moment, what are we seeing as sort of the key talking points? I know there's a ton of stuff around convergence. There's the remote access
Yeah.
piece. There's legacy products at play. There's new tech coming in, AI. From your standpoint, what are you sort of seeing at the moment at a high level?
Sure. Yeah. Lots of things to cover here. So, anytime you go into an industrial security or an OT security conversation, the first thing that every person is going to do is they're going to lay up what's called the Purdue model, right? Or the Purdue Enterprise Reference Architecture model. And that was made by an organization initially, the first standard of called ISA 95. And it eventually evolved going forward, right? Now, the whole point of this is it's not necessarily an architectural diagram for you to see how the industrial environment is broken up, but it's to show you how assets are different and that data flow is different from what I'm going to refer to as the control environment or the control network and the business network, otherwise known as the enterprise network. So, more specifically, The fact of the matter is they're two completely different worlds. You have your traditional enterprise and business networks, think printers, office computers, anything that's making those operational business work, right? For example, anything that's in the office space or what we call corporate space. And then you have the industrial environments where these processes are actually happening, these moving pieces of things going up and down, colder, hotter, faster, slower. Now, what's interesting is there needs to be a divide between those. And going back to what you noted earlier, the digital convergence, right? It's incredibly important because we see today, and it's terrifying, and I feel terrible for a lot of the companies that you Google cyber attack every single day. And it seems like progressively we're seeing more and more attacks and more groups that are targeting these industrial plants. And when you think about a power grid going down or a water treatment facility losing those chemical processes or nuclear centrifuge spinning faster, I mean, this is the real world and it's terrifying, folks. So the first things first is when you have that convergence, an organization first needs to be able to split and differentiate between the control network and the enterprise network by implementing what we call an industrial DMZ. That's your very, very first line of defense that says, here is your entire network on the enterprise side. Those are all enterprise assets. That's it. It will not communicate down to the industrial network. On the other end, you have the industrial network that's composed of all those OT assets, right? So all the machinery, all the processes in the background that's making those processes work, whether it's from an operational standpoint or actually moving like functionality. And between that, the IMDMZ, it's almost like a push-pull. They're both talking into the IDMZ. It takes the information and it pushes it to the other end. And the reason why you have that is because think about ransomware. We're seeing it everywhere. And this can happen simply from a phishing email, right? Somebody gets a social engineering attack. You see that, you know, whatever, that great shiny gift card to a Bahamas vacation for $5,000, and you decide to take you and your grandma and everybody else, and you click on it, and now you have ransomware that's propagating throughout the environment. Without that IDMZ there, it could pivot straight into your industrial network and now start shutting down the machinery, now start affecting that machinery. Wow. So the first line of defense is an IDMZ, and depending on how you're even deploying your IDMZ, that still may not even be enough, right? So the secondary thing is human threat and insider threat is still a massive issue today. You can have that IDMZ deployed, but if somebody just walks right into your plant and there isn't a good physical security program, they could take a USB, they could plug up to any port that's available on some of these devices, and now they can be inside that control network. Typically, the average attacker will be inside a network for at a minimum of 6 months conducting intelligence throughout the ICS kill chain for their next step. Think about if somebody was chilling in your house, eating all your food for 6 months and you had no idea they were there, right? That's horrifying. So it's kind of crazy. So with all that being said, there's a couple big things that every organization has to start with maturity level. Number one, build out an IDMZ, separate your enterprise and your industrial networks. That is huge. You don't want to have one asset that's serving two roles, which is what we refer to as a dual-homed asset. Because in the event that it's compromised, it's now playing in both fields. It's a gateway to either side of the house. The next thing you want to do is you have to have visibility, right? And when I say visibility, if you go ask a lot of people in the industrial environment, hey, give me a list of all of your assets. What is communicating with what? Which sort of protocols are you using? You got to think, as you mentioned earlier, James, a lot of times these assets are legacy. They're outdated. They've been there for 20, 30 years, right? Typically, it's tribal knowledge that they didn't have handbooks. It's just people that are so experienced with how that plant is functioning. It's not written down anywhere. So they may pull an Excel spreadsheet out of their locker on a local computer that doesn't have details for what exactly is there. And why that's alarming is in the event there is a cybersecurity attack and you don't actually know the IP schemas of all the products. You don't know the MAC addresses. You don't know what sort of protocols, or even worse, vulnerable protocols that are communicating between each other. You're completely lost in the sauce. And those attacks, they're going to start pivoting incredibly fast. I mean, within seconds, right? So the thing here is you have to have visibility to understand which assets are there. How are they communicating with each other? What sort of firmware are they running? What is the hardware, the series, the model? Are they vulnerable, right? You have to have a vulnerability management program to understand Hey, are these susceptible to a cyber attack? Is this another attack vector that could potentially be compromised? And then bring that back to vulnerability management program, otherwise known as a patch management program. So the full scale visibility is actually serving as a catalyst for the rest of your industrial security program. Without visibility, you have nothing. So visibility is key. It's key. It's key. It's key. It's key. I can't say that enough. I wish I could have it stamped on my jacket right now, right? So after that, when you have visibility, that's when you have to start moving more to a micro segmentation piece. And this is where a lot of organizations struggle that we see is you have that IDMZ. Once you're there, great. We like to call that you're in the crawl stage. Okay. You're on all fours, you're trying to figure out how that's going. You get visibility, you're almost like a crawl walk phase, right? You're like trying to get up there a little bit, you're stumbling every now and again, but at least you can see. You got your whereabouts. Now the next step is that micro segmentation. Let's say in the event that a cybersecurity attack does happen, and now it's in your industrial environment. Again, you gotta have some kind of plan in place to mitigate that, right? To secure some of the most critical assets. To give you an example, there's these things that are called safety PLCs or SIS, safety instrument systems. These are what's considered the last line of resort assets in an industrial environment. Think about it this way. Let's say that you had a roller coaster that's going through the entertainment park, right? Typically, when you think of entertainment, you don't think of, man, that's critical infrastructure. Like that could really impact something, but it's one of the most severe out there, right? When these roller coasters are going through tunnels, there's geofencing that's constantly applied to them. So regardless of the weight, they can only tilt a certain amount one way or another. Because if you think about it, if they tilt too much, now they could potentially run into something in the tunnel. You could potentially cause fatalities. I mean, it's a very heavy thing. The safety is paramount. If those are compromised, you could have a whole coaster potentially go faster than it's allotted to. You could release seat belts. There's a lot of different things that could go wrong. A safety PLC is a last line of resort, or a safety instrument system is a last line of resort that pretty much says if an anomaly is identified that meets a certain criteria, or if you want to manually override it, that safety PLC will kick in and it can disconnect a piece from the network, right? So it could take it away so that way that attack can't propagate into it. Enforcing stuff like that is an amazing example of micro segmentation. Now, this can work even more at a high level and not as granular as safety PLCs, but even in the processes themselves. So going back to maybe an oil and a gas refinery, right? Maybe every process or critical process has its own segmentation with firewalls. So you have one cell that's segmented here, another cell, and another cell, and then they feed up kind of through that Purdue model data flow up to the IDMZ, and then you have your enterprise network above that. So that way, even if an attack does come through, it's not what we call a flat network. And a flat network meaning a completely unsegmented network. So you have more security controls in place. Think about it like you're trying to go into a bar and a club when you're in college and the bouncer's checking all the ID cards, right? You may be able to get to the first one, right? If you're sneaky, not saying I did that back in the day, but imagine if there were three or four bouncers there that checked you at every point, it'd be a lot harder, right? That's the best analogy that I could come up with. That was on the fly, so we got to appreciate that for a
I'm loving the
second.
analogies. We're doing roller
Yeah.
coasters, we're doing nightclubs. We'll chuck
That's
in the
right.
odd oil and gas refinery, but yeah, let's
It's
keep it
7 a.m. for
universal.
yeah, that's exactly. So that's where we're at. So I'd say that the biggest thing is going back and keeping it short is IDMZ segmentation, full scale and holistic visibility, and micro segmentation. Now, these are all from a technical standpoint. A lot of times when you look from a policy standpoint, you also go ask people about their incident response plans. And they only have response plans for the IT side of the house, right? You have to heavily incorporate operational technology in an integrated incident response plan or have a dedicated OT, ICS, IoT incident response plan because they're completely different worlds. And in that plan, you need to include the cybersecurity aspect, you need to include the industrial processes, you need to have a table of when to communicate with who at every step of that incident response, whether you're going through the NIST incident response or the SANS incident response plan. And you need to have backups for all those people for every step of the way, and even run training and tabletop exercises to understand how that response would work. Because if an event does happen, it's almost like going to a fight, right? Or training for boxing. If you never trained in your life, how are you going to be ready when somebody punches you, right? So you gotta plan, you gotta formulate and have that specific incident response plan. So micro-segmentation, full-scale visibility, the IDMZ, and having a full-scale and holistic incident response plan that includes operational technology.
Got it. And so you're seeing organizations that maybe aren't as mature down this road, haven't got these in place, even maybe the IDMZ point.
Oh, 100%. I mean,
Wow.
majority of organizations out there, scary enough, depending on what vertical you go to, nothing, completely flat network. And they're still trying to implement an IDMZ in the first place. Now, if you look at traditional infrastructure verticals like oil and gas and utility, they're typically very, very mature in the micro segmentation piece. Maybe not so much of the visibility piece or the incident response piece. They may have a disaster recovery plan, which is how they recoup industrial processes, but it doesn't include cybersecurity. But if you look at other things like rail, the rail industry, or manufacturing industries, maybe something that hasn't, well, rail's always been critical, but manufacturing specifically, they're typically very flat. So I would encourage any organization out there that's listening, you're not alone. And the great thing is there's a ton of resources out in the community for every vertical of infrastructure. And there's a ton of people out there willing to help as well.
Yeah, that's all. And I think you raised a good point there, that it's like you're not alone. You won't be the only company experiencing these growing pains or these changes. And I mean, what is a common challenge? Even if we just take that IDMZ point, I'm guessing at some level the people in those organizations will know that an IDMZ is they're maybe better off having one than not. So where does the challenge sit of, is it a budgetary thing? Is it a process change thing? What's the sort of stumbling
Yeah.
blocks they'll come against?
Yeah, it's a phenomenal question, man. So a couple of things here. First off, you always hear the cybersecurity field, there's always a need for more people. We need to get more cybersecurity specialists. 100% true. If you take 100 cybersecurity specialists out of the 100, maybe one of them has experienced operational technology, right? So the community needs industrial or OT security specialists more than anything else. They can't find talent fast enough, right? So little plug there as well. But one of the issues with a lot of these organizations is they don't have OT security personnel. Nobody understands anything about industrial. So they don't even have the background knowledge, the experience to support a program like this. And a lot of the times what happens is if you take a SOC, a security operations command, and you have a console, anything they're viewing these sort of threat indicators or views. Think about cybersecurity team. You see in the pictures with panels of all over the place and their own keyboards simulation right there, right? Yeah. So you take a lot of time, the IT teams, they're now tasked with OT responsibility and they're completely lost in the sauce to think that now you're monitoring a power grid, for example, it's overwhelming. So it's hard because you need to be able to augment that skill. They don't have the skill to discuss that area in the first place. You think about even CISOs. A lot of times CISOs will grow up and doing business development, sales, they're doing maybe they're network architects, but they've done nothing for industrial network architecture. So it's educating the community about how exactly you start. So the first thing is the experience. The second thing is this is a long-term strategy. Again, you're going to have to go through a crawl, walk, run, and then put your cape on a fly phase. And it's not overnight. So if somebody comes and they pull a Purdue model up and they start talking about micro-segmentation and how to get visibility here and all this, you got to take it in bites. This is a massive, massive overhaul. And, it's a long scale plan. So it could be pretty overwhelming for people. And they need to have buy-in from their top level executives to have that budget, as you mentioned. And all the while understanding things and using the community as a resource to know what's going on, best practices, and getting involved with other organizations that may have similar issues, right? They may be closed off or not want to communicate with the community, or maybe they feel, I don't know, maybe a little embarrassed or not want to open up about the confidentiality of what their network looks like. But it's incredibly, incredibly helpful to have other use cases. And it's awesome because we're seeing more and more customers that say, hey, we'd love to talk with anybody else that's doing this. So now you're building those relationships and they can learn from one another. And there's these things that are called ISACs, information sharing analysis centers, for pretty much they're in IT as well, but they have them for operational technology, for manufacturing, for electrical, for oil and gas. And it's pretty much massive communities that come together in that vertical and can discuss these rising and emerging threats, best practices, how these new architectures look. So budgetary experience and roles and responsibilities that are dynamic that people may not understand.
Yeah, I got you. And so when it comes down to going back to the IDMZ piece, you know, is it often from your point of view of does an incident happen? Then they might engage someone like yourself to come in and review why an incident happened. Or is there maybe a voice internally that twigs and says, look, we need to get an IDMZ, and then has to go through that sort of approval, budgetary buy-in phase? Or is it a mix of everything? It's a really broad question, I know.
Yeah, you know, I think it's unfortunate, man. I mean, there's a ton of different flavors. I've had customers that have come to me and, you know, regardless of what hat that I had at the time, and said, we've been attacked, like, we don't know what to do. Or we were attacked 3 months ago, and now we're trying to essentially stop the bleeding, eradicate the threat, and figure out what exactly was affected. I've had other customers that come to us and they just say, hey, we know we need this and we're behind. We don't know where to start. I will say, the way that a lot of regulatory authorities are going and policy regulation, it's encouraging a lot of people in the community to start moving towards best practices. You think about, in the last year, the SEC released the rule that any material cyber attack has to be reported within 4 days, that says what was affected and what their current response plan is. That is huge, because now they're obligated to tell their customers that something happened and the processes that were affected. And if you can't confidently tell your customers what were affected, then you're going to lose loyalty and trust, and also potentially face other repercussions, right, from a regulatory authority. We've even seen now recently in the last 2 weeks, I don't know if you read this or not, or you've seen this, and you know, it's been all over the news, is ransomware actually attacked an infrastructure and they didn't pay the ransom, and the ransomware reported the organization to the SEC.
I saw this, yeah.
So, which was unbelievable, right? So it's almost like another arm of leverage. I couldn't believe it when I was reading it. But, you know, so you're seeing stuff like this. And now I think the community is being forced to impose some of these regulations and to do better best practices. And there's other things coming out too. In the last year, the Office of the National Cyber Director in the White House has pushed out several memorandums saying that they're going to establish baseline cybersecurity standards within the US. And then, right, then you look at other things like privacy laws and concerns too, and how data is being shared. That's another thing you have to incorporate. So, and then, you know, in the US specifically, the TSA for all transportation, like rail and freight, critical aviation systems, maritime, they are also held accountable and required to create cybersecurity assessment plans, cybersecurity incident response plans that include visibility, segmentation, and threat management, like we talked about earlier. So I think everything is funneling. And, you know, although this is a major overhaul for the community as a whole, it's a step in the right direction for the better good of not only that organization, but for citizens like you and I across the world.
Yeah, no, I think absolutely. Because, you know, like you say, you and I will see what happens if X goes wrong. You know, it's terrible when a cyber attack happens and a business loses money or reputation and things. But yeah, in the OT space, it's got that added, you can't get insurance maybe for high speed rail going wrong, or you can't get insurance for, well, because of the implications of what will happen. So no, yeah, I think definitely something to look at.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier too about the incident response piece. I would encourage any company that they are still building out that maturity, or they don't have OT security expertise, to go reserve a company with an incident response retainer. There's a lot of companies out there, but if something happens to happen, God forbid, and I hope it doesn't, at least have a company on standby, maybe a premium up front, but it'll pay dividends in the future.
Yeah, worth it getting out of the bank early doors. And you just touched on it, just to finish up here with, you mentioned that there are industries out there, utilities, oil and gas, that are maybe a step or two ahead of maybe other organized industry verticals. Is that because of regulation? Is that just because of the length of time they've been going, size? Where does that come from?
Yeah, for sure. Utilities specifically, they're governed under what's called NERC-SIP, or FERC. So they've always had very strenuous cybersecurity requirements for anything that is under this broad category they call bulk electric systems, or BES, more acronyms the better, right? To just throw on. We should have
Let's get
counted
them
how
all
many
in.
acronyms to put in the podcast.
Yeah, it should be like bingo, shouldn't it? Like an
That's
end of year
right.
game. We'll just see how many times that's been said.
That's right. That's right. So utilities typically they've been governed under NERC SIP, so very strenuous about being audited, right? And then you think about anything that involves chemicals or hazardous materials, hazmat, that also has its own requirements. And then some of the verticals are less mature than others, right? Like, for example, with the TSA, with all these directives they pushed out to earlier, as mentioned, maritime, freight, rail, critical aviation systems, now they're required. But some other verticals, like manufacturing, they may not have had as strenuous oversight. So I think now they're starting to become more and more forced to adopt these best policies as they see attacks happening all around. So, I would just encourage any company to get out there, talk with an architect like me or somebody else or whatever it is, whether it's personally or professionally or networking or whatever. But everybody's happy to help. I'm happy to help. At the end of the day, we just want to see people succeed, and nobody wants anybody to be painted under a bad light, or God forbid, have a water treatment facility tainted or a cupcake poisoned or a nuclear centrifuge spin faster. I mean, it's very serious stuff, and people want to help, right? We have a real passion for this.
Yeah, and that clearly comes through. That clearly comes through. And just finishing up here, what are you excited about, Q1, Q2 next year, over the next 6, 12 months or so?
Yeah, I mean, personally for me, in my what we call business unit at Cisco, we've got a lot of really, really amazing things. A lot of times, whenever you think about troubleshooting and maintenance, you have to have a third-party vendor come in and actually look at the device that's broken because people can't do it internally due to service agreements and warranty. This actually opens up back doors a lot of times that they can come in at any time and change anything in the industrial environment. And majority of the time, it's not actually monitored or logged. So just take a second and think about the security implications that might potentially have. So what I'm really excited about is at Cisco, we've been promoting a product we actually just created called Secure Equipment Access
Okay,
that
cool.
fixes that problem for remote access and is actually embedded in the hardware in industrial environments, made for industrial environments, made for every vertical that solves the issue of remote access. You can tell who's coming in, when they're coming in, why they're coming in. It records every action done, and you can terminate a session. So anytime that my company pushes new stuff out, I get really excited. And that's something that I think I'm taking as an early Christmas present. So if you have any questions about that, reach out to me too.
No, yeah, absolutely. F feel free to. And if people want to reach out, Cam, where's the best place to reach you? Obviously, you're on LinkedIn. We'll chuck a link into that. Is there an email to get you on, or is it LinkedIn only? What's the way you work?
Yeah, I really appreciate that. I'm always on LinkedIn, so feel free to ping me on there. You can ping me on my Cisco email, kchumley@cisco.com. But regardless, if you just need advice for career stuff, if you have questions about critical infrastructure or OT security, feel free to ping me at any time. I'll help anybody when I can. We can hop on a call. I don't care if you're a stranger or not. Just say, "Hey, Cam, listen to your podcast," and I'm happy to help, and I'll do whatever I can.
That's awesome, man. I'm sure everyone will be happy to hear that. And hopefully there's been a ton of valuable points through the conversation we've had, at least I from my point of view anyway. Hopefully the listenership feel the same. Let's wrap up there, and we'll speak again soon.
Awesome. Thanks, James. Really appreciate the opportunity, man.
Thanks, Cam. Bye-bye.